Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We don't often get good news in that war these days, I'm sorry to say, but I am very pleased to be able to present a little bit, at least for the moment, and to call back to our microphones for that purpose a man I've come to admire greatly and who has been indispensable in bringing about this bit of good news. He is Marc Labouy. He is the founder and director of Point de Bascule, or Tipping Point, a web-based investigative magazine that you can find online. It's based in Montreal, Canada. And this bit of good news comes there from Canada, from Quebec province specifically. And to talk a little bit about it, I'm delighted to say congratulations and welcome, Marc Labouy.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, Frank.
So tell us about this development. Bill 59 is something that you've been warning about for some time. You've been working hard against, and I think as a result, in no small measure of your efforts, it's come undone. Talk a little bit about what happened.
Well, Bill 59, of course, is technically a censorship bill. And the current government in place is called the Quebec Liberal Government, gave in after a lot of a backlash. The backlash against the bill would not die down. Now, the entire civil society, I could say almost with just a couple of exceptions, have been opposing this bill systematically for months. It's been almost a year that's been very actively pushed forward. And then there's the opposition to the bill, PQ Representative Agnès Maltais, who stood technically almost alone. She was doing what I think in English we call a filibuster, which she would systematically oppose the bill and what she called intelligent opposition. So out of 60 to 80 hours of debate over the bill, only 1.5 articles out of something like 25 were read. It was systematically asking questions. And Agnès Maltais basically got it. There's quite a few politicians, they may participate in these types of debate, but sometimes they don't really get it. Well, she did get it. She expressed a couple of weeks ago that she felt that this was out of about 20 years of as a politician, she felt this was the most important and significant debate that Quebec has ever faced in terms of the danger that it was for democracy.
This is so important, and Marc, I want to make sure while we acknowledge and express appreciation for this this sort of Horatius at the bridge in the Parliament, Agnès Maltais, your own role in helping get that civil society engaged on this issue, understanding the implications of this censorship in the name of not offending Muslims, was incalculably important. And you may not want to boast about it, but let me just say thank you to you specifically. I was struck by the Minister of Justice in Quebec, Stephanie Vallée, indicating that while this kind of regulation of so-called hate speech is adopted elsewhere, she said, quote, "We're not ready for that," unquote. So it doesn't necessarily mean this is a commutation of sentence. Maybe it's just a stay of execution. But in that regard, Marc, talk, if you would, a little bit about how things seem to be developing in terms of trying to classify as racism so-called Islamophobia and what implications it might have.
Well, there is what we call now, we're noticing a form of access. I mean, Islamophobia bills or efforts or lobbies trying to push Islamophobia. We know that it's happening all over the West, But there is a particular axis right now developing, which we call the Paris-Brussels-Quebec-Ottawa axis. There is now an organization in based out of Paris, led by a man by the name of Marwan Mohamed, who is very close to Tariq Ramadan, close also to organizations that are linked with Youssef El-Kardawi out of Qatar. And he's also very, very close to not just Muslim Brotherhood operative, but also other Salafist-based Islamist operative who are known to have radical views in France. And they're working together with, for example, recently they have met very, very powerful lobbies out of Canada called the CARE Canada, or the new name, the NCCM, that they're using. And they seem to be coordinating a lot of effort to push institutions and policies inside of Canada to be able to qualify to or equate Islamophobia as a racism. And if this would be happening, what that means, it's even worse than having a bill that would do censorship. It would take on the current laws on racism and just basically hook onto them or piggyback on them, and then would be able to have the same effect in order to chill free speech, chill criticism of anything that's related to Islamist activities in Canada and maybe in Europe.
Now, I know, Marc Leboeuf, that you have been accused of being an Islamophobe. I certainly have. Many of those we work with have. Just dissect for us this concept that this is, in fact, some sort of racism. There is no race. Islam is practiced by people of many different races. And what I think we all are concentrating on is not even Islam itself, as much as it is the political, military, legal doctrine of Sharia that its Islamic supremacist adherents are trying to impose on all of us. And if we were to accede to this idea that that this is somehow a racist activity, where would a country like Canada find itself? Where would, you know, people like you who are warning about what's coming if they're not careful?
Well, there definitely would be even more difficult than it is now to be able to name the threat that we're facing, specifically the jihadist threat. It would be extremely difficult to notions of infiltration, and I'm talking about serious infiltration inside government agencies, when we would try to expose how certain lobbies, association, or individuals are trying to penetrate a political party, a police force, a legal institution.
Or the government itself, for that matter.
The government itself. There's this leader called Jamal Badawi out of Canada, and I think he's very known in the United States, who basically in an interview in the early 2000s says that Muslim should penetrate government institutions, specifically become judges so they can use their own personal discretion in order to avoid applying legal references that will go against Sharia. So he is encouraging Muslims to enter and penetrate and infiltrate, become lawyers, police officers, and any type of form of positions of power that allows to have a certain amount of discretionary power.
As you look at this effort on the part of the Islamists, the Islamic supremacists, to promote Sharia, when you find yourself confronting these pressures, Mark, just as the takeaway from your efforts on Bill 59, what should all of us learn from it and take heart from?
Well, on our part, I think having the information well-structured, intelligently put together, was able to help some of the people that are pushing these policies, some politicians that could understand what's happening, to be able to be well-equipped to articulate a defense and even sometimes even be on the offensive. So documenting what these organizations are doing, quoting them, knowing exactly, and also exactly like you said, the memorandum is a perfect example. There are so many plans out there to demonstrate that there is a coordinated effort to disrupt our civilization, to change laws. There are plans out there that clearly express that.
Mark, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but there's so much more to talk about. I look forward to doing so with you, and just want to say hats off to you and all of those in Canada who have fought this important fight. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy joins us. We'll talk about how this problem is manifesting itself here, thanks to our so-called friends, the Saudis, among others. But more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Kyle Scheidler, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he directs our Threat Information Office, really a go-to resource on the challenges that we're facing from the jihad, both of the violent kind and the civilization kind, among others. Kyle is an expert in these matters. He previously served as a director of research and communications at the highly esteemed Endowment for Middle East Truth, and has been a contributing author to, among other things, its book Saudi Arabia and the Global Islamic Terrorist Network, America and the West's Fatal Embrace. Kyle, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Frank.
Let me ask you about Saudi Arabia. It's been getting a lot of attention, much of it critical of late, as you know, in particular in connection with the possible declassification at long last of 28 pages of a congressional report looking into its involvement as an official government operation in the 9/11 attacks. Kyle Scheidler, you know a lot about the Saudis. Give us a sense of the likelihood that the Saudis were doing such a thing.
Well, the Saudis were almost certainly, they had some level of involvement. What exactly that is remains to be seen. And obviously, if we were able to access these 28 pages, these classified pages, we would know a lot more. What we do know, of course, is that the Saudis for a long time played a role in the sort of support and finance function of organizations which then supported al-Qaeda. We're talking about organizations like the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, which was the sort of Wahhabist organization that the Saudis used to fund mosques and fund Islamist organizations, which then in turn funneled money to al-Qaeda. So the Saudis play the most key role in creating the infrastructure which then undergirds all of what al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups were able to accomplish.
We're visiting with Kyle Scheidler of the Threat Information Office. He directs at the Center for Security Policy. And Kyle, you were just touching on an incredibly important point, it seems to me, and that is that what the Saudis have been doing for a long time, whether it's through this so-called WAMI, the World Association of Muslim Youth, or organizations like the North American Islamic Trust, has been building mosques, which in turn create, as you say, a kind of a support network for jihadists of the violent stripe, as well as the sort of pre-violent kind, as I call it, the civilization kind. How do they do that? Well, I mean, what is the funding mechanism, and what are the orders of magnitude of what they've put into this enterprise?
Well, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars, and they do it through a variety of different ways. Obviously, they have the sort of international structure, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth and other groups like that, which are moving money around to various other Islamic entities, which then are in turn controlling and building the mosques. And you mentioned the North American Islamic Trust, which is a good example of that. The North American Islamic Trust is an organization of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. We know that because of documents that were submitted at the Holy Land Foundation trial. But its real job is to hold the deed to U.S. mosques. And so that then enables them, that is the Muslim Brotherhood and other Saudi-supported radicals, to use those mosques for their recruitment, for their indoctrination of people who will come to be jihadists by moving them through stages of indoctrination and recruitment. And so that's what we saw in the lead-up to 9/11. You saw individuals like, for example, Anwar al-Awlaki, who worked out of Dar al-Hijra Mosque in Falls Church, and individuals like this still to this day play a very key role in recruiting and indoctrinating individuals to jihad terrorism.
When you see what the Brotherhood has been doing, Kyle, it's unmistakable that it's about jihad, of course. But what does that tell us? What's the relationship between the Saudis and the Muslim Brotherhood? Obviously, the supporting of their activities is going on. But I had thought at one point that the Saudis had actually declared the Brotherhood a terrorist organization, had they not?
Well, they had. The on-again, off-again relationship between the Saudis and the Muslim Brotherhood is one of these things that, as Westerners, were perhaps often befuddled by. Prior to 9/11, and certainly prior to the takeover of Egypt by the Muslim Brotherhood, the Saudis had largely used the brothers as a part of the transmission chain for the moving of this money and this radical material, this Sharia-adherent material around the world. But following the takeover in Egypt, the Saudis became very concerned that they themselves would become a target. This is the sort of relationship that the Saudis have always had with Islamists, is because despite their own support for these causes abroad, they are not interested in seeing those same forces turned back on them and risking their control of the Arabian Peninsula.
It's kind of, I guess, a protection racket. They wind up supporting these guys with the condition that they wage their jihad someplace else, not in the kingdom. Let me ask you about one of the most prominent Muslim brothers that we know about, Kyle, a fellow by the name of Jamal Barzinji. Give us a sense of his background and his involvement with the, well, with the Brotherhood for sure, but also perhaps with the Saudis.
Well, Barzinji passed away in September of last year, but during his time in America, he was the co-founder of the International Institute of Islamic Thought, located in Fairfax, Virginia, and it's a very prominent Muslim Brotherhood think tank. They really kind of provide some of the intellectual backbone for the Civilization Jihad project that the Muslim Brotherhood carries out in the United States. In fact, one of their they introduced the term civilizational battle to talk about this idea of a conflict between civilizations at the ideological rather than at the military level. Additionally, Barzinji was the founder or one of the founding members of the Muslim Students Association, which was the first Muslim Brotherhood organization in the United States. He was the general manager of the North American Islamic Trust. He was a member of the Shura Council of the Islamic Society of North America, and he was a director of the Safa Group, which was a network of charities and companies in Northern Virginia that was raided by federal authorities for funding Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. He was also a member of a number of other Brotherhood organizations as well.
So this is quite a pedigree. What do you make, Kyle Scheidler, of the Threat Information Office, then, of the fact that the White House, which has been quite embracing of Muslim Brotherhood operatives and organizations here and abroad for some time now, has decided to pick, of all people, Jamal Barzinji's grandson, Zaki, to be its head of public outreach to this Muslim community?
Well, you might say to yourself, perhaps the son didn't follow in the footsteps of the father, which would, one, indicate to me that you don't understand the nature of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it is very much a family enterprise. But you would also need to know that Zaki Barzinji was himself the former president of the Muslim Youth of North America, which is another Brotherhood-oriented organization that was named in the explanatory memorandum of the Brotherhood when it was found in that house of that Hamas operative in Virginia and entered into evidence at the Holy Land Foundation trial. So this is an individual who is a leader of a group, a named group, that the government is well aware is associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, and yet he is being selected to represent the U.S. government to Muslim Americans in this country. And that sends a terrible message, but it has been a message that the Obama White House has sent uninterrupted since he took office in 2009.
It's nonetheless staggering. Kyle Scheidler, we thank you so much for the work that you do bird-dogging these various organizations and their influence operations, their subversion, their civilization jihad here in the United States as well as elsewhere around the world. Keep it up, my good friend, and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Gordon Chang. We'll talk about the latest North Korean missile launch and President Obama's appalling visit to Hiroshima. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us. Friends, and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The most important responsibility of the American presidency is to safeguard the public against all enemies, foreign and domestic. It's a task the next occupant of the Oval Office is likely to find more challenging and vital as the world becomes more dangerous by the day. A damning report released last week by the State Department Inspector General confirmed that Hillary Clinton violated a similar public trust in her last job. Specifically, she knowingly and deliberately used email communications arrangements that violated her own official policies. In the process, Mrs. Clinton exposed to hostile powers, presumably thereby compromising, classified and other sensitive government information, making us all less safe. It remains to be seen if Mrs. Clinton will be prosecuted for such misconduct. What is already clear is she has shown herself disqualified to serve as Commander-in-Chief. This is Frank Gaffney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the high privilege of being each week, by Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving Asia, from which he has recently returned. He is a columnist for Forbes.com and blogs at World Affairs Journal and regularly contributes now to the Daily Beast. He is also the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, you've written the book on North Korea taking on the world, and I want to give you the first crack at commenting on the news peg of the day, which is that the latest of North Korea's missile launches has failed, I think, the fourth of this particular system. What are we to make of the difficulties that the North Koreans are having with their missiles? And is there any prospect that somehow this will translate into relief from the threat that it's increasingly posing to us and others?
I'm very surprised that the Musudan missile has failed four times, because this is something that should have worked. I think part of it is because Kim Jong-un has probably imposed some political deadlines for tests, and scientists were just in no position to tell him, no, that's the nature of the North Korean system. But nonetheless, the North Koreans make progress even if there are failures. Matter of fact, they probably make more progress when there are failures because they learn about their systems. So these are missiles which eventually they will get to work right. And when they do, this particular one will be able to reach Guam and American forces there. And they also have long-range missiles we know that do work, and those longer-range ones can actually hit the west coast of the United States. So there's no relief in sight for us.
That is what I was afraid you were going to say, and I think you're absolutely right about it, of course, Gordon. The Japanese were on a fairly high state of alert as a result of the possibility that one of these things might be headed their way. Gordon, this is against the backdrop of the G7 meeting that was taking place in Japan, President Obama's much ballyhooed visit to Hiroshima, which we'll talk about in a moment. But given the growing threat to not just us, but to our friends in the region, did this feature prominently, this danger from North Korea, in the G7 meeting?
Yeah, the G7 did talk about geopolitical issues, but especially when it came to China and the South China Sea, because there's growing concern that with the UN arbitral decision expected in weeks, that the Chinese will try to do something in the South China Sea to change the conversation. And that very well may be starting to reclaim Scarborough Shoal, which would be a game changer. That would be a real inflection point. And so the G7 talked about these issues, much to the consternation of Beijing, which threatened the G7 because Beijing said that they should not discuss issues relating to China's territorial ambitions. The big issue of the G7, though, really was discord on currency and economic coordination. There is a lot of discord between the United States and Japan on some of these issues, especially because the Japanese are weakening their currency. And at the same time, by the way, the Chinese are setting their currency lower as well. So this is going to be an issue that is just not going to go away, even though there was no agreement at the G7.
Gordon, let me turn to another matter that has prompted some discord and may even between us, I'm not sure, but always in a harmonious way, of course. Namely, the president's visit to Hiroshima and the remarks that he made there on the eve of Memorial Day weekend in this country. What did you make of them?
Yeah, there's so much to unpack from this. I think the most important thing is something that we Americans tend to overlook, and that is the president, by merely showing up and by making a few remarks, did actually win a lot of acceptance from the Japanese. And the reason is that the Japanese do feel threatened by not only the North Koreans, but by the sponsors of the North Koreans, the Chinese. And so, therefore, the president going to Hiroshima, I think, actually was important in the sense that it showed that the United States was standing with the Japanese people. He is now wildly popular in Japan. And also, I think that he got a certain amount of acceptance elsewhere in the region. So there's a lot that one can criticize the president for on this visit, but I think the most important thing is that he did show the flag, so to speak, and that was well received in the region, especially in Japan.
Let's, as you say, unpack that. He may have shown the flag in the sense that he was present, as no sitting president has been, in Hiroshima. But the message that he was sending, I would think, would not give much comfort to the Japanese. It was the kind of, the sort of thing that has really been the making of the sort of lunatic fringe for many years, namely that we're going to rid the world of nuclear weapons and that the United States is going to do its part, among other things, by disarming substantially or allowing, at the very least, the atrophying of its deterrent. I wouldn't think that would actually give comfort to the Japanese, who have long nestled under our nuclear umbrella. What am I missing?
There's a lot there. Whatever one may think about the cause of nuclear disarmament, which goes back, of course, to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which went into force in 1970. Ronald Reagan's advocacy of this cause, which he was passionate about. The problem is how you go about it. And during Obama's tenure, there has been unprecedented proliferation in East Asia and indeed around the world. He has a lot of these agreements that he's signed up, but he has not enforced them. So, for instance, the Russians look like they are going to violate the New START Treaty, which was signed in 2010. They're already violating the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Agreement, that landmark 1987 deal, and that could really unhinge the world. And I talk about this because Russia is an East Asia power, and it does have influence in the region. Of course, the Chinese are building up their nuclear arsenal very fast, and we all know about the North Koreans, which they set off their fourth known test in January of this year. So, as I said, there has been unease in the region that the United States has done very little to stop this very worrying slide to what some people could say would be Armageddon in Asia.
And Gordon, I just have to qualify one point. I had the privilege of working for President Reagan on nuclear forces policy and remember vividly that while he had an aspiration to get to a place where the world was so safe that we needn't have nuclear weapons, and for that matter, we wouldn't need the kind of conventional forces that we would otherwise have either. But he knew we were a long way from that, and he undertook on his watch the modernization of our arsenal that has basically been essential to keeping us secure all this time, ever since. So I wonder whether, again, the takeaway here is going to be, in the end, when those threats from the North Koreans, those threats from the Chinese, those threats from the Russians, and the proliferation of these weapons elsewhere continues to metastasize, that this president's legacy will be one that either the Japanese or the Americans, for that matter, will find all that laudable.
Yeah, well, at this point, you know, clearly, as you say, the president's record in Asia with regard to nuclear proliferation is really unenviable, because there has been this spread, and there's been very little of American and other pushback to this. So this is really going to be the legacy. As I said, you know, whatever one thinks about the ultimate goal, the president has not been able to put in place those policies that have been able to make the world safer. And when we look under Reagan, this whole concept of strength is something that eventually led to the failure of the Soviet Union. You know, we've seen nothing like that in Obama's term, and that really is, I think, the crime. And as we go forward, it's going to be really important for the region to have faith in the United States. Otherwise, we will have that situation where countries like South Korea, Japan, even Taiwan will develop their own nuclear deterrent because they are they feel the United States would be unreliable. So this is something where the region has become so much more dangerous in the last 7.5 years.
Keep up the good work, my friend, at The Daily Beast and Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com and Fox News. And, of course, in our regular visits here, we'll talk with you next week. Next up, we'll talk with Mike Norris, the director of Armageddon, a pop culture wake-up call on the threat of electromagnetic pulse. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hello, I'm Ace Lyons. As a retired 4-star admiral who served as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, it is a special privilege for me to talk to you about an important new book just released by the Center for Security Policy, China Prepares for Conflict, and Why We Must Do the Same. The book explains that while the Obama administration has dithered over the deterioration of the Middle East and ignored Asia, China has been moving to challenge and displace the dominant role the United States has played in this region and the world since the end of World War II. I am one of 9 co-authors of this important book. The others are former Senator Jim Talent, Gordon Chang, Peter Navarro, Kevin Freeman, Bill Gertz, Frank Gaffney, Fred Flights, and Dean Chang. I explained in my chapter how China's efforts over the last 20 years to seize control of almost the entire South China Sea is an indication of new assertiveness to advance its regional dominance at the expense of the United States. I take issue with President Obama's benign neglect of the threat from China and how Beijing is building islands in the South China Sea that it plans to turn into stationary aircraft carriers to threaten freedom of navigation in this region. Like the other authors of this book, I believe the next president must act immediately to restore American leadership and its military power, both of which have been seriously undermined by the disastrous policies of President Obama. We urgently need to modernize and increase the size of our land, naval, and air forces to stand up to China and other adversaries worldwide. We also need to recognize and counter the growing cyber and intelligence threats from China. The bottom line is that our nation needs to act now. I strongly commend this important book, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. You can read it for free as an ebook on the Center's website, securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It is a distinct pleasure to welcome to our microphones for the first time, I believe, Mike Norris, a legend in Hollywood in his own right, but also the son of another Hollywood legend, actor Chuck Norris. Mike Norris is a director as well as an actor. He has appeared in a number of films on television and in the big screen. including Walker, Texas Ranger. He directed the film Birdie and Bogey, among others. And most recently, and the purpose for our talk today, is to discuss his brand new film, Amerageddon. It is about, well, a subject near and dear to our hearts here at Secure Freedom Radio, the possibility of bad guys taking down our country using a technique known as electromagnetic pulse. Mike Norris, thanks so much for joining us to talk a bit about this, and congratulations on Amerageddon.
Thank you, sir. It's an absolute honor and a pleasure to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about the film, if you would, please. I don't want to do any spoiler alerts here, but can you tell us a bit of the plot and why it's really required viewing?
Absolutely. And I'm not worried about spoiler alerts because, you know, what our film deals with is an EMP attack that goes off over the United States of America and the chaos that ensues afterwards, with the martial law being brought in, United Nations troops coming in, and then trying to take our guns from American citizens. But the EMP attack in the film is the catalyst of our story, which is a very, very hot topic right now in the world, electromagnetic pulse.
Well, it certainly should be, because I think, as you've indicated, it's a real problem in the world today. People are more aware, if they're thinking about this vulnerability of our electric grid at all, to some of the other more prosaic means by which this could be accomplished, taking it down, that is, physical attacks on transformer substations and cyber warfare. But give us a sense of why you felt the need to address this in your film, the electromagnetic pulse problem particularly.
Yeah, absolutely. My partner in this, Gary Haven, who sold his Curves franchise a few years ago, really wanted to, he was very passionate about EMPs and the devastation an EMP would have on our country were it to happen through a nuclear device, a cyber attack, even a solar flare. It doesn't really matter. But if our power grid goes down, life as we know it in America ceases to exist immediately. And I know, and I'm really new to this because I was really brought on to direct the film. But, you know, I didn't want to go in unprepared and unknowledgeable. And what I find interesting, very interesting, is we could actually harden our grid for $2 billion. That's all it would take to harden the grid. And our government has failed miserably to even act on protecting the grid. So it's a very real and scary thing that's going to happen. And the purpose of the film is to really get people to just start asking questions. What if something like this were to happen? What do we do then?
Well, and this is so needed, Mike Norris, because as you know, most of us take absolutely for granted the fact that the power is going to be on whenever we flip that light switch. We wind up, I think, with the exception of a bad storm here or there that interrupts all of that briefly, generally, fortunately, assuming that it will always be thus. And yet, in your film, you talk about the distinct possibility that people who want to take down the country have figured out how they can do it extremely efficiently and quite possibly even without fingerprints, really. So when you look at this, Mike, and I think that number, $2 billion, which was, of course, the product of a Blue Ribbon Commission paneled by Congress to assess this danger, it may be low, frankly, but at least it's an indication that this isn't a huge task. It's just one that, if it isn't undertaken urgently, could be a huge problem, right?
You're absolutely right. We go through here in Texas, we go through storms where our power will go out for a day or two. And to me, it feels like the end of the world, especially in the summer if we don't have air. I can't hook up my telephone, the internet. But, if you go down the ladder a little bit, think of the millions upon millions of people that are dependent on the government for whatever it may be, food, services, anything.
Water, telecommunications, transportation, finance, you name it.
Exactly. Everything shuts down. We won't have access to our money, no banking. And I believe wholeheartedly that the people that are relying on the government are going to – chaos is going to ensue once that happens.
When you say relying on the government, I think you're really talking about relying on the power, the electrical power, much of which is in private hands, Mike, rather than in the government's hands. But it may feel like it's the government that you're expecting to deliver that.
Well, I think a lot of people look to the government to protect us, and that's one thing they have failed on, and that is hardening the grid. And in 2008, in a congressional report, it was stated that an EMP would cause more damage than anything else that could happen to our country. And that was in a congressional report. And still, nothing's been done about it.
Well, you've done your homework, clearly, as has your partner in crime there, Gary Haven, with this new film, Armageddon. And when you look at the challenge that we're facing, Mike, and much of the film obviously deals with how people try to cope with the consequences of this preventable disaster, is your takeaway like mine that the difficulty of doing that, particularly for the vast numbers of us who, you know, really, as you say, depend upon electricity, is such that we need to prevent this from happening in the first place, not just try to pick up the pieces after it does?
No, I agree 100%. And that's how our movie starts. We lay out the facts of how do we prevent something like this happening. And when those words go unheeded, well, that's when our movie starts after the EMP attack. So it's a very real and a very scary thing. And I try to, you know, one thing I really encourage people to do is just to be prepared. I mean, heaven forbid this does happen, but I think for a minimal investment, people could prepare themselves enough to kind of withstand the onslaught. You know, it's common sense. Have extra food, have extra water. Here in Texas, hey, we have our guns and we have our ammunition. And I would hope that's the way it is around the world. But it is a very real threat. And the thing with Armageddon is we just wanted to lay out a bunch of questions for people to then go back and do their own research and find out on their own, you know, what is it I can do to protect myself? Well, who is it I could contact to, you know, talk about this problem? So it was very well thought out very early on in the process that this was more of a film. It was very much an educational piece that we wanted to get out to the world.
You know, I just have to say, Mike Norris, that you mentioned in Texas you have your guns and you have your ammunition. You also have one other thing. And that is you have your own grid for most of the states, which I think just lends itself really to Texas being, as it so often is, the leader in the country in protecting not just the people of Texas, but demonstrating how the rest of us could be protected as well. And I know your governor, Greg Abbott, has indicated that this is a priority for him. I hope he'll act on that priority and your film will impel him to do so. I know Senator Bob Hall down there from the state of Texas is also very actively working on this. And I just want to salute you and thank you for making this film, Armageddon, to alert not just your fellow Texans, but all of us to this real and present danger and the possibilities of doing something about it. Mike Norris, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back to us soon after a considerable box office success with this film. And I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.